Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. The Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival is the big event this week, so today we'll be talking with some of the festival guests. First-time novelist and Oprah pick, Ayanna Mathis, author of The 12 Tribes of Hattie, playwright John Bickenay, whose new work is Mold, and Elena Passarello, author of a book of essays called Let Me Clear My Throat. It's a pleasure to speak with novelist Ayanna Mathis, author of the best-selling novel The 12 Tribes of Hattie. It's an astonishing debut describing the lives of a family marked by the Great Migration from the South to Northern cities. The story of Hattie Shepherd, her 11 children, and one grandchild, who settled in Philadelphia. Hattie's loss of her first twin babies and her struggle to make a life for her family mark the lives of her children in unforgettable ways. Ayanna is speaking with us from Iowa City, where she is teaching in the Iowa Writers' Workshop this semester. Welcome to The Reading Life, Ayanna.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
You must feel that you've come full circle teaching at the place where you've studied writing. And The 12 Tribes of Hattie was written in just 2 years there. I mean, I think only in writing would we say just 2 years. And this is a novel that spans decades, from 1925 to 1980, as well as generations. That's very ambitious in terms of a time frame.
When I began the novel, it wasn't my intended sort of, I'm not a person who tends to map out things that I'm writing or things like that. I just began generating what I thought at first were short stories and then realized were chapters once I realized that I was actually writing a novel. So I didn't start the project thinking I'm going to begin in 1923 and end in 1980. It's sort of how it evolved, I think.
You said that you wanted to write a book about mother want, which I think is such an evocative term. Would you describe that a bit and describe Hattie and her children in terms of that?
Well, certainly, you know, Hattie is a woman who very much loves her children. I think she loves all of them very, very deeply. But she goes through a terribly traumatizing event when she's a very, very young girl with her firstborn children, which she has when she's 17 years old. So she's really just kind of a child herself, just married, just moved to Philadelphia. And she experiences a life-changingly traumatizing event. And that event, I think, has the effect of not so much curtailing or compromising her ability to love her subsequent children, these are her firstborns that I'm talking about when she's a young girl, but it does severely hamper her ability to be affectionate with them and to be tender and to be the sort of more typical kind of lovey, kissy, huggy kind of mother. She's very much sort of emotionally and physically withheld from her children. And I think that that causes in them a great desire for that kind of tenderness, obviously from their own mother directly, from Hattie, but I think it also creates for them in the world a kind of a strange vacuum in which they anticipate a kind of harshness from the world. And when what they want so often is simply, you know, a kind of soft shoulder to lay their heads on, and that's kind of what they don't have. And that becomes not only, as I said, a sort of literal need, a literal mother want, but it also becomes a kind of metaphorical want for tenderness and that kind of thing.
But some of the wonderful writing you have is about that longing for tenderness and affection, which kind of, you know, brings out your lovely poetic side, I think. You've had some fine teachers, of course, and you've acknowledged your advisor, Marilyn Robinson, who's one of my favorite novelists, author of Home and Gilead. But I love the way you speak of books as teachers, and you say that one of your great teachers was Beloved by Toni Morrison.
Yeah, it's a brilliant work of fiction, first and foremost, and it's instructive on so many levels. One of the ways that I found it helpful was I was very interested in my book in trying to understand how to manipulate the history of a character and the history of a character's sort of feeling about themselves, about their family. And Toni Morrison's novel, Beloved, it's a real study in the ways in which time is completely malleable in the right hands, you know? I mean, she moves back and forth through time in the most fluid and beautiful kind of way. In many ways, Beloved is a book about the past. and this almost as though the present of the book is the ghost, and the past is what is as real and what is driving the action of that book. But that's a pretty difficult thing to do without making a reader or yourself feel like you're sort of dwelling in backstory and things that are less important to the current action of the story, yet she seamlessly moves back and forth between past and present. And that was an incredibly good lesson for me.
Now, also, you've had that astonishing gift. You know, you've won the writer's lottery of having your book be a selection for Oprah Winfrey's Book Club 2.0. And one of the interesting things that does for writers, I think, is it gives them that rare opportunity to reach out directly to readers and kind of tell them how to read their book.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I find the opposite, you know, that people want to be left to make their own interpretations, but that they aren't encouraged to do so. I think that sort of the biggest gift of the Oprah Book Club is that it breaks down certain kinds of false and, I think, elitist barriers that surround what's termed as literary fiction. You know, like there's this sort of misconception, I think, abroad in the land, you know, that certain kinds of fiction are only for certain kinds of readers. So if there's a lot of, I don't know, metaphor or fancy language or whatever, that those books are really only reserved for a kind of hyper-literary elitist few. And I think that the biggest gift that Oprah gives to readers and to this country is that I think she's kind of a populist in general, and she's definitely a populist when it comes to literature, if I can use that term. And she says, look, these distinctions are false distinctions. Here's a book. It's worth something. Read it. Approach it. Don't be afraid of it. Bring it into your living room. And I think that that's what she does in some ways, even more than kind of telling people how to read something. She breaks down their own conception or misconception that they cannot approach certain kinds of texts and certain kinds of books. I think that's the sort of biggest gift that she gives us.
Absolutely. Now, another thing you've often spoken about is the need for friendship between writers. And one writing friendship that's been enduring for you is with Justin Torres, who's the author of that wonderful novel, We the Animals. And you've both had such great success at the same time. I wonder if you'd talk about your friendship just a bit.
We've known each other for a while. We didn't meet at Iowa. We met in a writing class, actually, before we got to Iowa. We overlapped for 1 year here. And it's just been an incredibly generative friendship in writing terms. He's often my first reader and the person that I sort of run things by. And because I think we're also such good friends, I think he has a real understanding of the way that I kind of process information mm-hmm. and can hear clunkers in my work, you know what I mean? in ways that are very particular to having a kind of a close relationship aside from writing. And I think the same thing is the case vice versa. You know, I read a great deal of his work and talk about it and can kind of understand intentions in some ways and whether or not the work is meeting those intentions. So it's just an incredibly, just really a gift to have such a good friendship that is also a writing friendship.
And both your books are so remarkable and so different and exciting to see that both of you have found such readership. Oh, well, we're very lucky to have Ayanna Mathis appearing at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival this year. She'll be speaking at 1 p.m. Friday, March 22nd on The Art of the Debut with Manuel Gonzalez and Kristen Page Madonia, and Saturday, March 24th at 4 p.m. on a panel called The South, The Literature of Exile, Refuge, and Return with Vivek Bald, Frank Cha, and John Jeremiah Sullivan. For more information, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. And more great news. Ayanna Mathis and Justin Torres will appear together at the Saints and Sinners Literary Festival here in May. Ayanna, thank you so much.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
John Bigaday is the Robert Hunter Distinguished University Professor at Loyola University in New Orleans. He's written 7 books, including The Torturer's Apprentice, Stories, and Oyster, a novel, as well as award-winning plays such as The Vulgar Soul, Rising Water, Shotgun, Night Train, and Broomstick, one I really love. At the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, he'll be premiering Mold, the final play in the Rising Water trilogy set in post-Katrina New Orleans. Hi, John.
Hi, Susan.
Welcome back to The Reading Life.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So So many New Orleanians have seen themselves reflected in the Rising Water Trilogy. And in Mold, you've moved us further along the time frame. Set the scene for us.
The play is set in the summer of 2006, approaching the anniversary of the levee collapse just a few days later. A young couple who've been in Texas the past year, having evacuated, return to a home totally encrusted in mold and have to decide whether to try to rebuild or to stay in Texas, where they have higher paying jobs, better housing, better schools.
And one of the things you capture in this play so perfectly is that essential catch-22 quality of life here after the storm.
I learned a lot by reading Kafka in writing this play.
I'm sure you did.
By the summer of 2006, people who were thinking about rebuilding were caught on the one hand by bottom line insurance companies that seemed to put up every possible obstacle to getting money to their customers so they could begin to rebuild, and on the other by a host of inept government agencies. The city on the one hand was doubling our property assessments while putting the same properties on demolition lists. And so the two other characters in the play besides this young couple is someone from City Hall who is determining which houses will wind up on a demolition list and an insurance adjuster.
And all of the characters, to me, seemed recognizable as people who were really trying to do the best they could.
And I think that was true. The adjusters were working 15-hour days, you know, trying to do their jobs, but they were caught by a set of rules that were designed to pay out as little money as possible. People in government were often over their heads, but they too were working hard trying to get the city back on its feet again. I hope that no one walks away from the play thinking that they've seen a villain on stage. They've just seen four human beings in extraordinarily difficult circumstances doing their best.
I know, and I think that's a remarkable thing to show.
Well, particularly when it comes to insurance adjusters.
Amen. Now, one of the things I love about these plays, to be perfectly honest, is how angry they are of so much emotion after Katrina. You've really channeled so much of that anger for people.
I'm still angry.
I know.
We had no streetlights from the time the levees collapsed until this past summer. 7 years, every night our street was in darkness. There are streets in Lakeview, for example, that I can't drive down because they're collapsing. Mm-hmm. So the story of the levee collapse is not over. It's going to continue for another 5, 10, 15 years.
Right. We're not done yet.
In fact, one of the characters says about all the stories that people tell in the course of the play, when are people going to stop telling these stories? 5 years from now? 10 years from now? 20 years from now? I don't think we're ever going to stop telling these stories.
I don't think so either. Now, one of the most incredibly eloquent portions of this play describes mold itself as the fifth kingdom.
It is. There are one-cell creatures, bacteria, vegetable kingdom, the animal kingdom, and the fifth kingdom is mold. It's an extraordinary kingdom. It doesn't move. It sends out spores constantly, propagating itself. We have very few defenses against mold, as all New Orleanians know.
Oh, yeah.
And even if you seem to kill it, its roots go deep into the wood it's attached itself to. And as soon as the house heats up again, the mold returns. All this research led me to have a great deal of respect for mold.
Exactly.
But to think of it really as another kingdom, another world, the fifth kingdom.
Now, what has writing these plays done for you personally?
Oh, I find it harder and harder to watch these plays. So it certainly has not brought me a sense of catharsis. What it has done, though, because I think there have been over 25 productions and stage readings of Rising Water and Shotgun, the first two plays in the trilogy, is to keep the story alive for the country. Invariably, if there's a talkback after one of the productions elsewhere, in fact, there was just a production of Shotgun in Salt Lake City last week, audiences always say the same thing. We had no idea that's what happened in New Orleans. We thought it was a natural disaster. We thought the hurricane did the damage. They haven't heard about the Corps of Engineers. They haven't heard about the levee collapses. They simply think that what happened to New Orleans was the same thing that happened to the Mississippi Gulf Coast.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think one thing that I've done, and I think all the other artists in town have done too, musicians, photographers, other writers, is to try to keep the story in front of the American people and to try to record an accurate historical record of what actually happened in New Orleans.
Now, I know you've always envisioned this as a trilogy, but are you through? Are you done? I mean, or do you think you'll go back to this?
I'm writing a novel right now about the first year after the flood.
Ah.
What happens in trying to find a narrative form is typically you look to other examples, but we don't have an example in the history of American literature of a city being destroyed. So there are no models here that a writer could use. When I looked at post-war German literature, Japanese literature after the Kobe earthquake, I found that those writers, in trying to talk about catastrophes that wiped out whole cities, often went deep into their own mythology. And so by using architecture, the attic and the roof and rising water, a shotgun double in the second play, and now a completely molded house, I found a kind of narrative structure that would work on the stage. A novel is a much more complicated narrative device, and so it's taken me longer to begin to figure out a voice and a structure for the story. But I'm about 100 pages in now.
Yay! I can't wait. And now you're in this awesome time where the Rising Water trilogy is being done all over Louisiana.
Yes, Rising Water at Swine Palace Theater in Baton Rouge. Acting Unlimited is doing Shotgun at Theater A10 in Lafayette. And now Southern Rep will be doing Mold at the Contemporary Arts Center.
So have you been moving around the state, checking things out, going to rehearsals?
I go to the opening nights.
And
so I'm on the road quite a bit these days.
Are you going to miss the theater when you go into that kind of prolonged period of writing a novel? Is that going to be...
Things are going to happen simultaneously. Broomstick, which you like so much, is going to premiere at New Jersey Repertory Theater next September.
Great.
And so I'll be in the Northeast working on that play. And I have two or three other plays that are already in gear. And I'm finishing a number of short stories right now. I've really gone back to the short story this past year.
Well, it's been a rich time for you, hasn't it?
It has been, now that the streetlights are back on.
We've been talking with John Biguenet, whose new play, Mold, will be presented as part of the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. For more information, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. And for tickets, check out SouthernRep.com or call 504-522-6545. Thanks so much, John.
Thank you, Susan.
One of the most interesting books I've read recently is Elena Passarello's essay collection, Let Me Clear My Throat, which is about some amazing moments in the history of the human voice. Elena Passarello is also the first woman to win the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival's Stanley and Stella Shouting Contest, an event she describes in this book. She's a writer, an actor, a voiceover artist, and an assistant professor at Oregon State University. Elena, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi. Thank you, Susan. Thank you so much.
I'm so happy to hear your voice again.
Well, a little less volume.
Maybe so. Now, this year, you'll be making quite a triumphant return to the festival.
I am. I'm really excited. I went in 2010 as just a member of the madding crowd, and this next time I'm going to be a panelist, and hopefully up on the balcony for the contest, if I can weasel my way up there.
Oh, well, I think you're well qualified for that.
Hope so.
Well, your essay about that experience, Harpy, appears in this month's Oxford American, which is so wonderful. But describe for us what it was like not only to do it, but to give so much thought to that one moment.
Well, I've always been obsessed with the Marlon Brando scream. I think it's one of the quintessential moments of American vocal culture. The whole book is essays on the human voice, and when I was putting the book together, I knew that I wanted to write about Brando, and I also knew that I wanted at least one essay in the book to be about what it feels like to make an extreme vocal noise, to sing opera or to do some kind of trick like ventriloquism or to scream. And the only way that I could do that would be to give a self-report, I figured out pretty quickly, and I'm not an opera singer, and I'm not a ventriloquist, so I can be pretty loud. So I found out about this Brando contest, and I thought, this is the moment where I can do an essay about Brando and also give the reader some feelings about the sensation of what it feels like to make, I call them sometimes top 10 noises, like noises that you only make about 10 times in your life, usually under moments of extreme duress. So that's why I wanted to do it, and I thought maybe I would go down there and kind of lose, like George Plimpton. My goal was to make it into the finals and just write about what an ass I made out of myself. But, you know, I drank some bourbon and got pretty competitive and ended up working out just fine.
You had the tank top. You, had the,
you
were ready to go. Well, it's always a surprise to me. I always love hearing that sound echoing across the quarter when it's, you know, happening on Jackson Square. Now, one of the things you go into is that kind of in addition to how the sound is actually made, the emotions that are behind it. And one of the things you say that's so lovely is, it is mighty because it just hurts.
Yeah, I feel like one of the reasons that the Brando scream is so mimetic, so transferable, is because we hear Marlon Brando hurting his voice. It's the same reason we enjoy a lot of things like extreme sports or even something like ballet. We know that people are pushing their bodies to these places for the sake of art. And I think that's one of the reasons that we love the Brando scream, because I think we enjoy seeing that kind of a physical feat.
Oh, most definitely. And Brando's not the only one who's captured your attention in this book, of course. One of the wonderful essays is the essay about Howard Dean. I love that.
Well, the Dean scream sort of had an opposite effect of the Brando scream. Brando made that noise, and it solidified his place as a kind of cultural icon, or at least it did for people like me who heard it years later. Dean made that scream, and it solidified his place as a kind of an also-ran or a little bit of a sonic joke. I mean, Howard Dean fans will be the first to tell me that he did not lose the 2004 campaign because of that scream that he made in the Valair Ballroom in January 2004. But to the internet and to the media, he certainly did. He made this crazy sound, and a month later, he was out of the presidential race, bested by Johns, Kerry, and Edwards. So I wanted to write about what that is like. So Brando's Stella is this triumphant sound, and the Dean Bia, as Dave Chappelle calls it, is the sound of defeat. So I wanted to unpack that. It was really difficult because I had a hard time figuring out exactly how I was going to discuss it. And then I found out that Howard Dean was the same age, born the same year as Robert Plant, Ozzy Osbourne, Alice Cooper, and Steven Tyler from Aerosmith. And I realized that he's the same age as these rock screamers. So even though he picked the wrong venue, he was really his "ah" that he made. Really kind of like a rock and roll scream, just in the wrong place. He's a screaming baby boomer. So I
right.
Kind of what the essay was about.
Now, even though you say you're not a singer, part of this book, Tips on Singing, and you have some remarkable essays about, you know, Johnny B. Goode's hurtling through space, and Judy Garland, and Farinelli the castrato, and Caruso, and Sinatra, and Elvis. So what's it like for you, if you're not a singer yourself, to listen to those voices? Do they inspire you? Do you sing along with them?
Oh, yeah. I mean, back when I was an actor, I was known as an actor who sings, which means an actor who can carry a tune but should not be playing Maria in West Side Story. So I do have knowledge. I can read music. I know the way that the voice works, and I know how the diaphragm works. And so I have a semi-professional respect for singers that comes from a personal place. But really, I'm just a listener. Most of the people that love singing and love music are not singers themselves. And so when I listen to Sinatra or Judy or Joe Strummer from The Clash, just like most listeners, very excited to hear somebody sing well. They're doing something that I can't do. Just for the same reason, like I said, that we watch football or ice skating or rhythmic dance, you know. we watch people take their bodies and do things with them that we have the same parts and we could do, but we just aren't as professional at it as they are. They've mastered the art of vocal expression. That's kind of the place that the singing part comes from.
Now, one of the most interesting things to me is that so many writers struggle so long and so hard to find a voice, to find that literary voice. And you seem to have found your writerly voice by writing about it.
Oh, thank you. It sure does feel like a struggle. I'm sure that everybody has their own. It was difficult for me to figure out what I wanted my book to sound like. There were a lot of false starts, and you know, I went to grad school for 3 years and wrote a lot of apprentice-y stuff, and I think I'm still trying to figure it out. I think the way that I work on a writerly voice is to find a new voice for every project that I work on, sort of minor bird writing, I guess.
I like that so much. We've been talking with Elena Passarello, author of Let Me Clear My Throat. You can meet her at the 2013 Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, Sunday, March 24th at 11:30, when she'll be discussing creative nonfiction with Thomas Speller, Daniel Brook, Dwight Garner, and John Jeremiah Sullivan. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for more information, and check out her essay, Harpy, in the New Oxford American. Thank you so much, Elena.
Well, thank you, Susan. It was my pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Maddie the Coonhound, the internet sensational dog, subject of Maddie on Things, a super serious project about dogs and physics, will perform Thursday, March 21st at 4 p.m. at the Tulane University Bookstore. Maddie and her human companion, Theron Humphrey, also appear Tuesday, March 26th at 6 at Octavia Books. Marianne Fitzmaurice discusses the Susie Homemaker Chronicles, Thursday, March 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Roger Kamenetz and J.S. Makos read Thursday, March 21st at 8 p.m. at the Goldmine Saloon. That's part of 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. The New Orleans Poetry Brothel presents The Confessions, Thursday, March 21st at 10 at the Always Lounge, 2240 St. Claude Avenue. Doors open at 9 and there is a cover charge. There will be burlesque, acrobatics, live music, tarot readings, and of course, the Poetry Horrors. Come for a private reading, stay for absolution. Poets include Jordan Soika, Kim Vodica, Adam Atkinson, Amy Asan-Savant, Anne DeLott, Chris Shipman, Jen Nunes, Katie Blooms, and Laura Glenham. Diane de las Casas and Holly Stone Barker discuss The Little Red Hen, that's R-E-A-D hen, Saturday, March 23rd at 1:30 at Octavia Books. Here are some events to look for at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival, coming up March 20th through 24th, headquartered at the Hotel Monteleone. Today's guest, Ayanna Mathis, appears along with Manuel Gonzalez and Kristen Page Madonia on a panel of The Art of the Debut, Friday at 1 at the Monteleone Queen Anne Ballroom. She also takes part in The South, Literature of Exile, Refuge, and Return, with Vivek Bald, Frank Cha, John Jeremiah Sullivan, and Elizabeth Stebe, Saturday at 4 in the Queen Anne Ballroom. You can catch John Biganay's play Mold at the CAC. For tickets, check out southernrep.com. And on Thursday, March 21st, there will be a special talkback with Biganay. It's an evening for bloggers and book groups. And you can hear the remarkable voice of today's guest, Elena Passarello, on a panel about creative nonfiction, along with Thomas Beller, Dwight Garner, and John Jeremiah Sullivan, Sunday, March 24th at 11:30 at the Queen Anne Ballroom. And shameless self-promotion here, I hope you'll come out to hear my panel on reading in the digital age with Pulitzer Prize winner Michael Cunningham, Fresh Air book critic Maureen Corrigan, and the New York Times' Dwight Garner at 2:30 Sunday, March 24th at the Royal Ballroom. For more information and tickets, check out TennesseeWilliams.net. Hope to see you there. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library will conduct a book donation drive Saturday, March 23rd, from 9 to 5 in the parking lot of East Bank Regional Library. That's at 4747 West Napoleon Avenue in Metairie. Donations of hardcover and paperback books, DVDs, CDs, and audio and videotapes will be accepted, but not magazines and encyclopedias. If you have questions, email friendsjpl@yahoo.com or call 504-455-2665 and leave your questions on the message machine. Donated items will be sold at the next big book sale, April 11th through 14th, at the Pontchartrain Center in Kenner. And Chris Champagne discusses his book, The Yat Dictionary and the Idea of Local Humor, Tuesday, March 26th at 7 p.m. at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.